Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. So, do you want marketing made simple? Shopify removes the guesswork with built-in tools that help you create, execute, and analyze all your online marketing campaigns. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/income. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Give my regards to Broadway. Remember me to Herald Square. Tell all the gang at 42nd Street that I will soon be there. Whisper of how I'm yearning to mingle with that old-time throng. Give my regards to old Broadway and say that I'll be there ere long.
Hello, all you theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome back to a bonus episode of Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history und legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. I am your host, Matt Koplik, the least famous and most opinionated of all the Broadway podcast hosts, and with me today is a very special guest. She is an award-winning actress. You might have seen her in a slew of off-Broadway shows such as Women or Nothing or Tribes, for which she won the Dorothy Loudon Theater Award for Excellence, or I might have had one of those words switched around, but those are the correct words in that title, not to mention her numerous TV and film credits. But currently you can see her on Broadway in one of my favorite plays of the year, Mary Jane. Please welcome Susan Porfar. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So happy to have you on. I'm a pretty, you know, Intuit theater lover. I see as much as I can. I'm pretty on the pulse. I recall briefly Mary Jane being done at the New York Theater Workshop, a production that you were also in, but yes. I didn't, for some reason or other, my lazy butt did not get over there fast enough to get tickets. And when this was announced with the lovely Miss Rachel McAdams, I was like, well, sold, I'm there. And I knew nothing about it other than Amy Herzog wrote it, and I had just seen Doll's House the year before, which was a phenomenal translation. And I gotta tell you, Miss Susan Porfar, from the moment it began to the moment it ended, I was a wreck. I loved everything about it. It's one of my favorite ensembles of the year. You in particular actually had a credit on my Instagram, which I will not share with you just now, but it's going to get posted later this year. I do sort of like fake Tony categories every June, categories that don't exist. And you're in one of them. And this was before I got the offer to interview you, and when your name popped up in my email, I was like, oh, click, 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 yes, 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 yes. So I was very excited that we got to do this today. This is a long way of saying, how did Mary Jane come into your path?
Lucky for you, we have this remount, so even though you missed it in 2017, you get to hear the story told anew. I was offered the play in 2017, before the pandemic, you know, and in its second incarnation. It had already been done at Yale, but it was its first New York incarnation. And it was an incredible experience. At the time, I had a newborn. So much of the experience for me was, there was also this incredible theatrical experience side by side with this like deep fatigue of being up in the morning and trying to like race home from the theater with, actually, we talk about pumping in the show. I was actually pumping backstage during that incarnation. And we all, the play meant so much to us. It's a personal story, but it also felt like it had reverberations for a lot of people that hadn't ever had any kind of experience with disability or critically ill children. Then, after we closed, there was some talk about a transfer. And as you know, the pandemic hit and various other things happened in the interim. And when it came back, I got a phone call saying, listen, it's going to come back. We really want you to do it. I didn't get the offer right away because when it's Broadway and a new producer and a new artistic director, everything has to go through proper channels. But lucky for me and Brenda, who also did it off Broadway, they brought us back to reprise our roles. And I think we've deepened them because we've had this additional experience of living through this pandemic. And also then, of course, we got another bonus 5 weeks of rehearsal with this incredible new cast and with Annie Kaufman and Amy. And they were coming to it like, this is a new play. So let's start from scratch. And we brought in tons of people to help us along with a lot of the research that went into telling this story.
That's wonderful. I was going to ask, for a production that is a remount, it is the same designer, same director, and two of the same actors, how you kind of go into something again that is the skeleton of what you've already done, but there are all new elements. There's a majority new cast. So as you said, it was approached just anew.
So I brought everything that I had learned with me, obviously, but then you have to create a new through line for yourself because everyone's scenes are they're primarily two-person scenes with Mary Jane. So the incredible Carrie Coon had done the role in 2017, and the equally fabulously talented Rachel McAdams is now in the role, but they're two very different temperamental beasts of this craft. So playing opposite of them naturally became there's going to be a learning process and a learning curve for, what is this new relationship? Because the scenes are all about the relationship between Mary Jane and the various caregivers or caretakers that come into her life. And I also think for myself, coming across the material was very different with a 7-year-old than it was with a 6-month-old. You know, I, for better and for worse, in ways, because I think a lot of, there was often times in rehearsal when I would think, God, did I say this line before? You know, I can't bear it. Like, was I in a fog? Was I even there? It's partly that the time went by, but it's partly that it really feels like I'm experiencing it new and for the first time.
Well, that actually, in a wonderful way, kind of it mirrors your characters, because your first character, Brienne, does have a newborn, correct?
Yes, she does.
And that's your first scene. And then in the second scene with Haya, I believe her daughter is a few years older, correct?
Yes. And Haya has a lot of kids at home. And her daughter is older. I kind of did the math to like piece together. So she has two younger brothers and an older brother and also. And like, so where is she? And like, she's got to, in my mind, she's at, you know, at least 4, 5, 6, because just to do the math of, she also has these two newborns at home. But you're absolutely right. I hadn't thought of that it mirrors my experience in the play. I think Brienne has a newborn at home, and Chaya's got older children. And Chaya also, you know, she's not only different temperamentally, she's like at a different phase of understanding what it means to live with the rhythms of a child who has a lot of needs. And honestly, that is such a cool thing that you're pointing out to me that I hadn't really put together, but I love that.
Well, this is what I bring to the table.
I love that.
Yeah. Well, what I love about, so every actress in Mary Jane, for those who've not seen it or read it, you know, it is focused on the character of Mary Jane, played by Rachel McAdams here, whose son, Alex, right?
Alex.
Yeah. Yes. Alex. Yes, he's about 2.5. He is almost 3. A line that gutted me. I would like to, when this production concludes, go to the library to watch Carrie Coon, because I'm like, I want to know how she said that line, because Rachel says it in a way that gutted me, and I'm sure that Carrie's gonna say it in a way that guts me. Anyway, my point was, every actress in the show plays two roles, and they, even though there are two different characters, they are similar.
They're linked, right?
Yeah, they're linked. They play similar roles to Mary Jane and sort of how they mirror her, but from sort of different ends. So one actress, April Mathis, plays a nurse, and then she plays a doctor, and you play another mother of a child with special needs. But in the first half, you are Brienne, who is new to this, and Mary Jane is, you know, counseling her. And then you're Haya, who has been in this actually longer than Mary Jane, so she actually has something to teach her. And I think that that's just... And it's not overt. It's not pandery in that way. Like, I didn't even realize those links until like the very next day. And I think that's very smart writing. And you guys don't really hit it over the head. It's just sort of very straightforward, which I appreciate. But that must be a wonderful
back
for you.
Actually, even the costume designer very subtly tried to thread the two characters for each of us. I mean, it's so subtle. Like, my Chaya has these bold stripes, and my Brienne has a gentle stripe in her the top part of her costume. And using like color palette or pattern or just in some way that the costume designer had an eye to, I want to draw like a little bit of a dotted line between your two characters. And Annie Kaufman, our incredible director, said, you know, it's not really like I want you to do some like disappearing act, so the people like have no idea, like that I had no idea it was you kind of thing. They're essentially, for a lot of us, I feel like we would describe it as like two sides of the same coin. Right. What I have really enjoyed watching Lily Santiago, because she has this one young woman who is so incredibly and recognizably awkward in how she interacts socially. And then we have her come in later, and she's a young woman working in the hospital, and she's so adept and socially immature in what she's able to offer Mary Jane. And often it's like, in one character, Mary Jane is kind of taking care of you, and in your other character, you're taking care of Mary Jane.
Yeah.
It's like they've talked about it as like a community of care.
And absolutely.
It sounds so like, ew, when I say it, it sounds so like cliche and like girly and like sisterhood of the, you know, but honestly, it's very elegantly done, I think. And it's not, like you said, I don't think we're pandering or, you know, going for like the goo factor of like, aren't girls great friends for each other? In fact, with Brienne, there's ways in which, like I said during rehearsal, and I think Rachel would agree, like, I don't think these women would be friends if not given this set of circumstances. I think they're in different social groups. I think they like have different priorities. Like what's her goal to as a job is to eventually, Mary Jane says she wishes she could be a middle school math teacher, and I'm like doing like PR for crisis management. Like, I don't think they were gonna like be people who like socialized if this hadn't brought them together. And I like that there's a little bit of friction. I mean, same with like talking to an Orthodox woman. Like, it's the situation and the context that like brings Mary Jane into contact with people, and Mary Jane is such a curious human. She ends up finding out a lot about every other woman that she comes into contact with.
Yeah, I feel you though about the, it's so easy to eye roll at things, especially with theater. I mean, it's so easy to poorly sell any premise to any show
I
ever,
know.
It's like actually it's a fun game to do. Like think of some of the most brilliant shows of all time and be like, okay, give it the worst one sentence elevator pitch of your life.
I know. I mean, like, is Community of Care like a big ticket seller? I don't
I
know.
think that's the thing though is I've had to sell shows to people that are like not necessarily throwing glitter on you of just like eternal optimism, but they are, beautiful, optimistic shows. For me, it was a very similarly linked to Kimberly Akimbo, a musical that I find very
Yeah.
bittersweet in its beauty and its hopefulness because it doesn't sugarcoat the sadness, but by not sugarcoating the sadness, you're able to highlight just how beautiful the other moments are. There was some show I just watched, and oh, you know what it was? It was The Wiz. I had just seen this current revival of The Wiz, and I'll leave my thoughts on that production in general aside. But Amber Ruffin did write a line that I liked, which was basically like the hard times are there to let you know just how good you have it,
Oh, yeah.
and I think that is something like a Mary Jane or a Kimberly Akimbo, and it's something that I remember. Jesse Green wrote in his review for your show, and I have a very complicated relationship with Jesse as a critic, but when he gets it right, he gets it very right. And I found his review for Mary Jane was so beautifully written because he mentioned your last production and sort of talked about the difference in temperament of Rachel and of Carrie, and said with Rachel, you really got the hope of the piece this time, that because she radiated such not toxic positivity, but like relentless positivity from within, it permeated everywhere.
That was a big thing in rehearsal was play the hope because the grief is there. It's
Yeah.
underneath. It's underneath it. It's not something you have to lean into.
Yeah.
And it's understood by the audience. And in a way, like a friend came to opening and said to me, like, actually in the first couple scenes, all the despair and the grief is very like sublimated. Like we don't see Alex. We hear the sounds, but we don't know exactly what they pertain to. And we're just watching a woman in like the rhythm, the daily rhythm of her life, things ticking along. And it takes a while to reveal the very intelligently, I think, on the part of Amy Herzog, takes a while to reveal what is behind the door.
Yeah.
What is Alex going through, and what kind of care has she been providing, and at what cost to her
Yeah.
sleep
Yeah, her
and
sleep, her well-being, everything.
anxiety?
And yeah, it's so fascinating because, I feel like well, so like with your character, you have Brienne and High End. There's a moment where Brienne does have a m small moment of breakdown crying. It's not, over the top, but, when Mary Jane is sort of t giving her information and telling her things you have to think of. And Brienne like has a moment where she kind of just has to take a soft cry for herself before she can continue.
Yeah. I
And
love
Haya
what we
doesn't.
No, Faya doesn't have that. Faya almost does, and then she's like, nope, not gonna do
Well, because
it.
I feel like Haya's probably already had that in the like the 6 years with her daughter. She's like, I've been there, I've done it. It's fun. Like,
There. Well, I also think there's a really big clue in the text, which is that Amy has Mary Jane say to Amelia when she visits, she says, oh my God, I'm so glad you're not meeting me in that first year. Like I was a wreck, which I take to mean like at any given moment you fall apart, right?
yeah.
Because at any given moment it's an o you're it's you're overloaded, it's you're overwhelmed, you're out, you feel like you're just up against, so much that is unexpected for yourself and for your child. And so I think that clue was like, oh, she's giving us a character who was very close to what Mary Jane might have been going through in her first year, and a character who's like past where Mary Jane is now. And, I don't want to say what may or may not happen at the end of this play because I think it's purposefully left. I think it's very purposefully left ambiguous. What is that last moment? But I like Chaya. I do hope Mary Jane has many more children one day.
Yeah, I
She's
think
so
we all root for her, and I think that I think what's as you said, the grief is there in the show, and to play it is to punish yourself and the audience. And
And yeah. I don't think anyone could take it. You know, I mean, you need the levity, you need the laughter. And like, also like, this experience is more than one thing for a parent. It's like the multitude, just like it is for any parent. You know, Rachel's character, Mary Jane, says, a friend told her in that first year, you'll still have good days and bad days. And at the time she thought, well, what kind of thing is that to say? But now she knows that was like the best thing anyone had ever said to her. It's like, you're still going to have good days and bad days, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, like a lot of, I was just thinking, I always think this, like when there's a part I really want, I'll think like, God, you know, I really want this part. And then I'm like, but you know, I'll still have to do the laundry. I mean, it's just like, or on the flip side, you know, you're going through a really challenging time and it's like, I still have to get up and make dinner for people. Like, mm-hmm. like you're still going to have, I still, and there's still going to be like, there still will be laughter. There still will be something to look forward to down the road. Like she really nails it when she says, this isn't going to just define your everyday now forevermore is grief. Like you're still going to have good days and bad days. You're going to have great days with Alex. You're going to get to go to a diner where his, you know, his suction machine can make as much noise as it wants. And it's not going to bother anybody. And that's a good day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's going to enjoy himself and you're going to be able to watch that. And you know, and it's a very human piece. And this has been a year that I've enjoyed. I've said this very many times on the podcast, as I've said in my intro, I'm a very opinionated podcast host. I feel like the plays this year have really just been like, all of you guys stepped up this year. And I was like, yes, I love all of you. You're all amazing. Especially because there have been so many plays about people and actual engagement, which I'm all for, you know, thematic plays and having big epics. I love all of those too. But I'm like, for every, you know, War Horse, I would like a Death of a Salesman or a Heidi Chronicles. And I feel like we got that this year with Mary Jane and Stereophonic and Appropriate, like plays about relationships and the human experience in ways that aren't so out there that we can still connect with them. And I mean, I
think they're like hungry for it as a culture, right? Like just, and I do want to say that as much as it's exciting that all these plays are on Broadway, they all began off Broadway, right? Is that true?
Not all. Mother Play opened straight on Broadway.
Okay.
But you guys, Stereophonic, Prayer for the French Republic, there's an Appropriate. Yeah, a lot.
A lot of them did. So as much as I'm like, it's so exciting for this to be on Broadway, I really want to give props to, you know, the people in that give the green light to projects like this off Broadway, where it's not like a slam dunk for an, you know, audience, bringing in the audience, but the play itself ends up like teaching us what we need to hear.
Oh, yeah.
Know, informing us like what audiences are ready to go through and experience and be up for. So like, thank God for that. Thank God for places where you can do something that's a little more experimental and, you know, it's not as punishing because it's not as reliant on just the bottom line of ticket sales and capitalism or whatever it all is, you know?
Yeah. Every piece of work that I really love that I'll then go down this huge rabbit hole of interviews and backstage, whatever. And the creatives behind the piece always say, like, you know, we did want to make something of merit, but also we're like, I don't know, what do we want to see? Like what would we want to sit through? Yeah. And anytime they were like questioning what to put in, what to cut, it's like, well, you know, would I want to sit through that scene if I like just went through an hour of such and such? And if the answer is no, it's like, well, let's cut it then. And I always feel like when you go from your personal experiences and your personal wants, those are the things that tend to resonate the most with audiences. I'm not a mother, famously not a mother. I do call myself mother from time to time. And I'm not a child with, you know, many needs outside of just my what I call Rain Man-esque knowledge of theater trivia and history. But I mean, I was so engrossed with this play and just related to the emotions of it, if not necessarily the circumstances.
Yeah.
And I think that's the power of storytelling, you know?
And also, I would encourage you, since you are like such a theater aficionado and nerd, but like if you are gonna go back, go see like every Amy Herzog play that recorded, because I had the same experience sitting in the audience for 5,000. Is it 4,000 miles or 5,000 miles?
I think it's 5,000 miles. I don't trust myself right now one bit. 4,000 miles.
Does it take to get from one set? What is it?
4,000 miles.
Yeah, 4,000. I'm like, how many miles does it take? So I'll go back to say to revisit 4,000 miles and After the Revolution and Great God Pan, now her translations. I mean, in all of them, I mean, just the experience I've had watching a show that Amy Herzog wrote or translated is always very profound. And she's just really got her like finger on like the way that like humans speak and what they need, and sometimes how they sublimate those needs. And sometimes like, I mean, there's just their gorgeous scene from 4,000 miles. I can still recall vividly of this boy and his grandmother getting high and like talking on a couch. And like, it's just, yeah, like that, those like intimate moments between humans that we're craving.
Absolutely. I mean, I definitely try to practice what I preach, and I tell my listeners, like, you know, expand your repertoire of writers, of works, and not just Broadway, but also off Broadway. I mean, speaking of New York Theater Workshop, I saw I Love You So Much I Could Die this winter, and that was beautiful. Jonah at the Laura Pels earlier this year was phenomenal. That's what got me excited for The Outsiders, because that was my first Danya Taymor production. So yeah.
Who was in Jonah? Someone told me you've got to go see Jonah.
And it was Gabby Beans was the lead of that play, and she was. Sometimes I am very early on the bandwagon for certain people and certain things, and sometimes I'm so late to the game. So Gabby Beans, I was very late too. I first saw her in Skin of Our Teeth a year ago or 2 years ago, and in Jonah, I was like, "What? That performance was just incredible." There's been so many wonderful pieces this year. It's not just Broadway, off Broadway, off Broadway, limited runs, regional. It's out there for everyone to eat up. So chomp chomp, everyone. But so with Mary Jane, you know, and it's not like, you know, a 10-year run, but you are doing this 8 times a week. It isn't something you have to kind of find fresh within you and within your company. How do you all sort of go with that kind of, because it's a structured schedule, right? You know, you have your 8 shows a week, but you have to make it authentic every time, especially for something like this. Do you guys have anything you sort of do together to kind of get into it, or is it everyone goes on their own journey in the show?
So on the one hand, I think that, you know, what's helpful is like that, you know the rhythm of pretty much, you know, the rhythm of your week. It's not like film and TV where it's, I have no idea what time I'm going to be called tomorrow until I go to sleep at night and wake up at 3 a.m. to see, like, did they text me yet? You know the rhythm of your week. I think that one thing is that, you know, we're not doing this show long enough to get comfortable or bored. I think we're still so early in our run. We're at something at like, you know, I was like laughing. Rachel was like, how can we be at performance number 8, you know, last week? Because we did a lot of previews and we were in rehearsal for so long, but yeah, we're still early in the run. So I think we're actually all still figuring out how to like harness the energy, but also how to rest and recover and put down the play for like when you get home or in the morning, so that you can replenish yourself. Because it's very exhausting to go through that emotional journey. No idea that you're not really going through this.
Yeah. Did you ever have a production where it was difficult to sort of leave the play at the theater and sort of relax at home?
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely had shows where like I wake up, and from the moment I wake up, I cannot relax until I get to the theater. I do the show. And then from like the time it finishes for like the next hour, I'm like, okay, I have 1 hour now where I'm not anxious. But this one, it's not anxiety, which is great. Maybe that's because I'm getting older and I've like figured out how to manage those feelings better. But it's more that it is I walk around with it. I walk around with it. I constantly am noticing things on the subway or the street that I'm much more open to or available to because of the nature of this material that I think, God, I'm like literally walking behind this Orthodox woman for like 12 blocks to just be like, how does she hold her bag? How does she hold her keys? What do you know? What's she want? Oh my God. Good. She's put it. Okay. Hold on. Hold on. Oh, okay. She drives. She's getting into the car with her kids. Like, okay. I didn't, you know, I'm trying to like, so it I'm following it and it follows me. I'm still like deeply in the curiosity phase of this.
Play. That's
7 years
wonderful.
Later.
Have you had anyone in your life, friends or family, see both the New York Theater Workshop production and this production yet?
Yes. And I will say that one thing that people appreciate, just to take the opposite thing of like everything starts off Broadway, is the one thing that they really appreciate is A, that it's like, it the size of the house enlarges, kind of enlarges the story, because it just by necessity you're now telling it to, you know, 600 or 50 instead of 150 or 200. I don't know how many New York Theater Workshop holds, but also that the effects, I don't want to give it away, but what happens with the set and the sound and the design has really, I mean, you can, is doing things now in this production that you can only do on Broadway, where you have the kind of ceiling and the house. And so that sort of the, everything has like come up a notch in terms of what you're capable of doing in this kind of house.
Absolutely. I interviewed someone, we weren't able to use the episode, but someone who worked on Hangman, and they said the same thing about the transfer from the Atlantic Theater Company to Broadway was the transition they were able to do with their set. They're like, it would just, you know, the intimacy of off-Broadway was phenomenal, but they're like, the ability to level up the design in a way was like, it helps so much. Sometimes a piece really does just grow even further in a larger space and, you know, with time. And it's lovely that happened with Mary Jane.
Yeah, I was worried, to be honest. I thought, well, how, this is a very small, intimate story, a lot of two-person scenes, but I don't know. It's filling the space, and it's benefiting from that leveling up of the tech, as you said.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I can only speak for my performance, but our audience was absolutely engaged the entire time. No one felt like they were restless or distant from it. There was one person, and I think it was in your scene. And I don't know if you remember this at all. And I was so, the entire mezzanine groaned because they're like, this idiot. Somebody did a quiet shout and said, I love you, Rachel McAdams. And in the middle of your scene.
Oh, you were there.
I was there for that one.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I heard that they removed that person. That's the only time that's ever happened.
Thank goodness.
Someone called out their love for Rachel while we were on stage. But I think we both, I'm proud of us because, you know, we heard it. We made eye contact and like felt it. I felt like a charge between us of like, okay, that just happened. And then we doubled down in terms of our attention and focus to one another. I mean, if you love Rachel McAdams, let the woman do her job on the one hand. On the other hand, I was like, okay, you know, the great thing about Rachel is she's probably bringing a lot of people to the theater that might not otherwise have a ton of experience coming to see plays. So, okay, I did hear that they removed that person. I'm not sure if that
I think the person was in the orchestra, so I didn't see it. If they did a ninja like job of it, because we didn't hear a word.
Because I think maybe there was also possibly some alcohol involved. But I will say that has never happened again. But what happened for us was I really felt like this electric charge between us, like, okay, it's you and me now. We cannot let that happen again. We didn't know if that person was gonna call out at any moment. So it bonded us in a way. And I really felt, you know, I've have really felt in moments, and I hope she has too, like we have each other's back. And, you know, when something like that happens, we're just going to more fiercely take care of each other.
Yeah. Which I mean, I could feel, because I hate moments like that. And same thing, you know, cell phone rings or anything like that. And that was a performance where luckily there actually wasn't a single cell phone that went off. There just was that one person. But every time I'm like, you know, In addition, you know, just the financials of putting on a Broadway show, part of the reason why you pay for your ticket and why it's the price it is, you know, despite the fact that the performance, there will be a performance tomorrow, that experience, that specific exact experience will never happen again, not with this group of people in the room, anything like that. And you want to live in it as much as you can, to pay attention to as much as you can. And I understand that one person being like, this is my shot to let Rachel know. And I'm like, she knows you're here to see her. She knows you love her. Like, let us all experience this moment with her together, because otherwise you're breaking the magic.
Breaking it for other people. Like, it's a communal experience. I mean, I did go see Pearly Victorious, and God bless those performers. I think like 7 or 8 cell phones went off. And then finally they stopped the show. And Leslie Odom was like, this is a communal experience. If you haven't done so yet, please, please turn off your cell phones. We're trying to have a communal experience here.
Yeah.
And then got right back into it. And
what a hero. Yeah. Cause I mean, what it was so wonderful about what happened with that moment with you two, as you said, you did double down, because then you have to work to get that magic back, and you were able to get it back so quickly because you were so committed to like, okay, that's not going to ruin this. We're going to bring this shit back.
And also, like, this play is about, it's great. It's wonderful that people who love Rachel McAdams, and I feel it, and I feel that energy, and I love it, are coming to see this. But ultimately, the magical spell should like lift it above and beyond any like singular love you have for her, and make it more about this larger story that Amy is telling. And mm-hmm. and it does have that effect if you know, if you allow it to like transform in a way from like the Rachel you know from movies to Mary Jane.
Yeah. You know? No, absolutely. It's, I mean, again, as you said, you know, if you love her, let her do her thing. But all, yeah. And you know, you're here to see her do her thing, but also she's in this thing for a reason. She's a part of this production for a reason, with all of you, with this writing, with Anne Kaufman, you know, not just respect her craft, but respect her choice to be in this and understand why she chose to be in this.
Yeah. I wish you had been there. You were there. But
I was there.
You were there, but I wish you had been able to say this. But you know what? It all like worked out, and is part of also like our own personal learning curve of like what it's like to do live theater.
I mean, I think it's a blessing that I wasn't sitting next to that person, because I don't think I would have gotten them out of the theater as quietly as the house staff did.
They were amazing.
No, it was one of those weird moments where it was someone who broke the agreement, and then everyone re-signed that agreement ever so quickly, and that doesn't happen very often.
Thank you for saying that.
You're welcome.
Everyone was like, no, we're the audience did the same thing we did. They're like, no, we're doubling down for you.
Yeah, it was, because I mean, at that point we were so invested and we were so in it, and we were all genuinely loving it. So we're like, yeah, I'm not going to let that idiot, right, you know, however misguided their intentions were, ruin that for me. I'm here and I'm going to get back into this. So I appreciated that. Was there anything about the show that I haven't brought up that you would like to bring up? Because, you know, you've been in the sauce with this far longer than I have.
Well, just the incredible art, the crew and the artistic team. And if I haven't said it, Brenda Wheel, April Mathis, Lily Santiago, are just incredible ensemble members. And I think really incredible people to collaborate with. They really make the thing fly every night.
Yes, all of you. I mean, so speaking of the Tony category that doesn't exist yet, that I'm nominating you for on my Instagram, I don't know if April Mathis has a memory of this from last May, but she was nominated in this same fake category that I had on Instagram for the piano lesson. So if you're like, so if you see her and you're like, April, do you remember about a year ago on Instagram, somebody sent you an Instagram post that you were tagged in for a fake Tony category for your performance in piano lesson? She's like, oh yeah, some random gay guy did do that. Yeah, that's going to be your category.
Okay, don't tell me what it is. I want to be surprised.
You'll be surprised. Okay, are you on Instagram?
In the piano lesson, she was brilliant. So I'll be in any category that she was in.
Oh, she was wonderful in that. Yeah. That was, and there was another category that I came up with this year that if I had had it last year, she would be in that as well, which is what I call the princess track of the season, which is, you know, you get such a short amount of stage time, but you really like get to eat when you're on stage. And because, you know, she's only in the second act of Pianolisten for such a short amount of time, but it's a meal. That wasn't the category though. So I'll have respect for you.
So memorable.
Yeah. Are you on Instagram too?
You know what's funny? My husband is on Instagram, so he's constantly sending me stuff about the show. The show, every time MTC posts or someone posts about the show, he's like, I'm actually not on it, but I will, if you post something about the show, it will make it to me.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Then you'll read it, and just know that was already settled before this opportunity to interview you even happened. This was just kismet.
This is kismet meant to be.
Absolutely. I also want for my own, the own integrity of my own imaginary Tony categories. I don't want anyone thinking that there was any kind of bribery going on, favoritism.
Or like that I had my non-existent publicist reach out, which I did not. I mean, I don't even know how this happened.
This happened just through sheer beauty of the theater community. My network, Broadway Podcast Network, sometimes sends us interview opportunities. So what I tend to do on this podcast, Susan, since you're brand spanking new to it, what I usually do is show analysis. I'll do like these mini series, themed mini series, and each episode is a different musical or play, and I bring a guest on, and we just talk about the show. We like break down the plot and the writing, as well as, you know, the history of the show, how it was made, and then like the landscape it came out in, what its legacy is. So, you know, like I just paused a mini series that we called Problematic with a question mark, shows that have had controversy around them. So shows like, you know, Downstate, Carousel, Miss Saigon, things like that. And we, you know, talk about it. And so BPN will sometimes be like, oh, you know, how would you like to interview so-and-so from Spamalot? I'm like, I don't think they want to come on and talk about the intricacies of Carousel. I think they want to come on and talk about Spamalot. But I pause that whole trajectory every year for the Tonys, and I do Tony episodes. And as, you know, the shows have opened and are campaigning or, you know, doing press for the Tonys, it's a good opportunity for me to branch out of that and interview wonderful people like you and lighting designer Corey Paddock from Gatsby and Spamalot, and, you know, Tony nominee Sally Mays, things like that. So this is like a little fun thing for me where I get to pretend that I'm a regular podcaster who just interviews good people about their craft and not a nerd who analyzes for 4 hours promises.
I love it. Oh, I'm going to listen to that. I want to hear that 4 hour podcast.
Nothing's 4 hours yet, but the Miss Saigon episode is 3.5 hours long. But I will say I've had a few reviews on Apple Podcasts that are like, oh no, the Miss Saigon episode, like that one, that's the good one. I was like, that's as long as Titanic, so go off. You can definitely look through all of those and see which ones inspire you. But yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned all of your castmates. They're all wonderful. Every time I how do you say Brenda's last name?
Wheel.
Brenda Wheel. Every time I see Brenda on stage, I always forget who she is, and I'm like, why does she look so familiar? And the first thing I always go to, and I'm sure she gets this all the time, is that she's one of the women that Annette Bening's trying to sell up the house to in American Beauty. The one who's like, she says, there's nothing lagoon-like about this pool. And that's what my brain always goes to. And then I remember I've also seen her in 12 other things.
Right. 12 other plays.
12 yeah. Other. But that's always, every time I see her, I'm always like, why does she look familiar? And then when I leave, I'm like, American Beauty. And then I remember the rest of her career.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I feel like she's just like a, you know, she's a treasure.
She is. And she sets a wonderful tone for the humor of Mary Jane when it begins. Because I think what I love so much of that opening scene is, you know, Rachel McAdams as Mary Jane. I mean, it's in the writing and also how Rachel does it, is that Mary Jane is so performative in that scene of just trying to have a friendly, normal conversation. And what makes it work is that Brenda is so natural. And just like not, and like her response to Rachel's like over energy and like performativeness is what gives that scene its humor, and also makes you understand what it is that Rachel's doing. Because if Brenda wasn't doing a good job, people would be like, oh, Rachel's like not really communicating the stage well like she does on film. I'm like, no, what she's doing is beautiful and brilliant. And you get that because of how Brenda's reacting to her.
Yeah. It's kind of a leap of faith that it's all going to work. And it requires like a lot of patience, I think, on the part of Rachel to like trust that she can lead like that, and that everyone will then go on this journey with her and be like, oh,
mm-hmm.
okay. Yeah.
Now I see where she's at, especially when she does have her moment of not being defeated, but like the darkness, the grief does kind of overpower her for a moment. And that's where Lily kind of bears the brunt of that and has to sort of absorb that from her. And yes, I know you just see the facets of this woman and all the women around her. And it's a beautiful, beautiful piece. And all of you, beautiful job. Gold stars all around.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And thank you for re-signing the contract with us after that disruption.
I'm glad you felt it. I'm glad that we had that moment together and we can reconnect about it now. Susan, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Really had a great time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I mean, I know you don't have Instagram, but is there any way for people to find you online if you want them to find you? A website? Any kind of...
Be like, wait, what? No one's on Facebook anymore. I am still on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
And also, MTC has like a really incredible social media department. They're on Instagram. So like they've been posting a lot of links, which I've then been sharing with friends.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go, guys. MTC, Facebook, if you really, really want to find her. But please be respectful. She is an artiste with a life of her own. And yeah, Susan, this might be a curveball for you. So we always close out every episode with a little Broadway singing diva that I'll put it in post to like, you know, play us out the song. But I always offer it up to the guests to think of a Broadway diva to sing us out. And we unfortunately can't do Miss McAdams, as I don't think she's ever sung in public. And I don't think Amy Herzog sings in public. But
I get to choose someone who I want to hear them singing.
Yeah. So like when you listen to this episode, when it comes out next week, you'd be like, okay, who would I want to hear finish out my episode?
Babs, for sure.
There you
does everybody choose Barbara Streisand?
You'd be surprised. Not a lot. A lot of people want to get very interesting, or they pick people they know. Sometimes it's like related to the show we talk about. I've only done Barbara, I think, twice. And
okay, if you've already done Barbara, I know who I pick. I pick Judy. If you've already done Barbara, I pick Judy Dench singing as Sally Bowles in Cabaret. You know she played Sally Bowles, right?
Susan, of course I know she played Sally Bowles.
Right, right. Of course.
I one of these days we'll meet in person and I will explain to you my childhood. And,
Because I went through like a phase of reading every line that Judy Dench ever wrote about her career and her life. Yeah. And I wish I could have been there for that. And then I went and found like her and Ian McKellen, you know, recorded
the Macbeth with her silent scream. Oh, so good.
I mean, and so yeah, it would have to be Judy.
Let's do that. I mean, happy to do Barbara if you want. I always do repeats on here as well. But if you want to do Judy Dench, I don't think we've actually ever done Judy Dench, so we can do her.
Judy as Sally Bowles.
Judy as Sally Bowles. It is fantastic. We'll either have her do the title song, or we'll have her do Don't Tell Mama. She's ferocious in both.
Okay.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Susan. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Give us a nice 5-star rating, a review if you like the podcast, and check back later this week for our next Tony episode. And that'll be it for now. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Take it away, Judy. Bye.
As for me, I made my mind up back in Chelsea. I'm going like Elsie. Start by admitting from cradle to tomb, isn't that lost?
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor, and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.